my pleasure to be here, and this talk was also already kind of rescheduled because I planned actually to give it last Thursday. So this is a talk about the vodka package and about the methods we have tried and played around with, and I mean the neat things we found out. And because there are also like a lot of new people, I added like some introduction slides to all the methods. I think for some of you it will maybe be not as interesting, but I think it's a good overview. And most of this stuff was actually done in Mainz and not in Los Alamos, when I was a postdoc with Kremer. And basically also we started developing this package like during my PhD, which is like 3 years ago. So this is kind of the multi-scale slides, which are a lot of talks, and I have stolen it from a review by Dennis and Kurt Kremer. And basically the idea is always that you have kind of a method which describes like one length and time scale very good, like quantum methods or optimistic simulations or coarse-grain simulations, and you basically want to transfer like information between the different scales, and that's usually you do a quantum simulation and then you get kind of the force field coefficients for optimistic simulations, and then maybe you can use optimistic simulations to come up with a more coarse model. And I mean, coming up with these kind of coarse models can be a very difficult task, and the idea is to kind of simplify this a bit with a package and to make it easier to do that. And when I talk about coarse graining, I usually mean systematic coarse graining, which means it's just a question of finding a model which basically preserves a certain property of the higher resolution model or the, let's say, reference system. So, and in most of the stuff I'm talking about here, it's the reference system is an optimistic system. And it is, of course, like a bottom-up approach. You already have like input from the high resolution system, and the coarse grain system usually has less degrees of freedom than the high resolution one, and that makes it kind of cheaper to simulate, and that's the reason why you can reach like bigger time and length scales. And with this kind of approach, it's clear that there is like a link between optimistic and the coarse grain representation. The first part of designing like a coarse grain model is usually to think about like new coarse grain coordinates, and that is has something to do with intrusion. Basically, you know, we have this like a polymer chain like this, and then I mean it's not obvious that you would map it in something like this, but it seems kind of natural because you have these kind of repeat units, and it seems logical to make like a coarse grain bead inside this inside every repeat unit. But of course, it's some kind of decision you make along the way when you design a coarse grain model. How do you map it? And this is now really like the simplest case you can imagine. I mean, you basically have the vectors of all the atomistic coordinates, which can be very long, and then you apply like a linear operation, this mapping matrix, and it can even be a block line matrix, because this is basically always the same kind of building up block. And then you get like a much smaller vector of coarse grain coordinates. One could also think about other coarse graining schemes where you basically try to coarse grain something in mode space or so, but that's not what I would consider here. So when you look through the literature, I mean there's a zoo of methods which you could basically use to do coarse graining, and just to make like a incomplete list here, I mean a big class of methods is basically so-called structure-based methods, which aim for reproducing certain distributions like the two-body correlation or the bond distributions. And as we have learned basically last week, this all of them basically minimize the relative entropy, and these are just like different ways of kind of getting to the results. And there's let's say the Boltzmann inversion and like an iterative version of the Boltzmann inversion, and the inverse Monte Carlo technique, which is basically invented by Sasha over there. So there's a method which try to, I mean, another class of methods which try to reproduce the forces, which is this the force matching algorithm, and basically Will Noyd put that forward very much. And there's also like methods which try to reproduce the solvation free energies, and that is what, when you, they do it with a kind of a simplex approach, basically finding the right parameters, and what comes out there is like the kind of Martini force field. Most of the time people are not only interested in one property but also in other ones, like in addition to the structure they want to reproduce the pressure or the diffusion or the Kirkwood-Buff integrals. And I mean, there are corrections which you can apply on top of these methods here to somehow fit more parameters than, or more properties than what was the methods originally designed for. And as I said, I mean, this list is very incomplete because basically every second day there's like an extension of a method in the literature. So let's do a bit of theory, which is necessary for understanding most of them. It's like the simulations are done like in a canonical ensemble, and when you do that, you have the Boltzmann distribution, and the easiest idea to kind of get like the effective interaction would be to invert that distribution. But that you can basically only do when you want to have like the potential for a certain degree of freedom if these things can be separated. And that is usually not the case. But I mean, there are systems for which this works very well. And I think the example basically always to mention is like bond interactions for polymers. There, basically, when one takes the bond distribution and inverts that, one gets a very good estimate for the effective interaction. And because this only works if these degrees of freedom are actually independent, one would like to separate, first of all, the stiff from the soft ones. And basically with stiff, usually in the case of polymers, we mean the bonded interactions, and with the soft ones, usually the non-bonded. And we do a special kind of simulation which basically samples one molecule in vacuum, and we exclude all the things which are later covered by non-bonded interactions and just measure basically the distributions which come from directly the direct interactions, and then we invert these to get the bonded interactions. And then we derive the non-bonded interactions with a different scheme, and I will come to that in a minute. Quantity to describe the structure of a non-bonded interaction is basically usually the Rayleigh distribution function, and that basically, as you all know, just measures the number of particles in a certain distance from a reference atom. And because it's very useful for the inverted Monte Carlo method, I will define this kind of S, which exactly is the number of particles in a certain distance from a reference particle, and it's basically, except for the prefactors, directly related to the Rayleigh distribution function. And then one can use basically the inversion of this Rayleigh distribution function as an initial guess potential, for the non-bonded potential. But as I said before, I mean, usually there's like these potential for the different things are not separatable. That means that it's usually like a not very, very nice, or not sufficient potential. So you need to do like a correction on top of that to actually really find the potential which reproduces the structure. And one idea to do that is basically, because if there's still a difference between the two Rayleigh distribution functions, one can basically come up with a recipe to just take the difference between the potentials of mean forces and use this as an additional update in this thing, and then automatically you will incorporate like all the missing terms into this potential. Of course, this is kind of a cooking recipe, yeah? So you do that, and at some point, possibly this thing will converge to the right thing, but it's not always clear that it will actually converge. I mean, in all cases we have studied, well, it converged, and it's like still an open question, so does it converge or not?
I have one question now. Every time this procedure, this very crude form of the log and G of R is used in all the presentations we've heard, but there are much more sophisticated ways, based on Perkovic-Jevic, et cetera, to invert a G of R.
Yeah.
And at least in the example, one of the examples I'll show, in one iteration, you got a potential, which then when you simulated, it got the right G of R, and it didn't take multiple steps. And so I was wondering, has anybody tried to do a much more, we know a lot of things about mean spherical approximation or Perkovic-Jevic equations for inverting G of R. At this stage, I would use those to get me a much better guess of G of R that likely would not have cost you more than one more iteration.
I mean, I'm actually not aware that somebody has done it for these kind of systems. Or
seems to be much.
It would be interesting. I actually was not really aware of that.
I can show you how for the one case where we had hard particles in a solvent, we tried to get rid of the solvent, but we had a G of R and you wanted to affect the pair potential.
Yeah.
They didn't have to worry about all these other variables that you were trying to fit, but if you just one of you from a G of R, there's a much more sophisticated way to invert it.
Yeah, but this is a much more complicated situation. You have an underlying structure which comes from a backbone, which you take care of before. And then you match the G of R or try to optimize the G of R.
Right, here you might have
unwanted interactions.
Right. So certainly if those other ones were fixed, you have a G of R, you want to invert it.
That would be just a general
question, the conversion of the G of R can be done much more sophisticated than this crude approximation. And I was just wondering if anybody tried that
for this kind of systems.
I think Riato did that, didn't he? And Gubbins have also done things like that.
Right, and lots of people have done it, not in the intention of making a many-body system with all the angles and bonds, etc. But to say that it's done by a lot of people.
Right.
But every time I hear these talks here, at least they're using this crudest approximation.
Yeah.
When you talk about G of R, are you doing it for all or just non-bonded?
In the cases which I will describe later, usually. I mean, we let the whole molecule to a bead, and then we only have non-bonded interactions. But for polymers, usually you do that for the non-bonded part of the interaction.
So
it's really on the GFR, it's on the non-bonded pair distribution function. For the bonded things, you basically already do the simple inversion from these exclusion scheme, which I showed before. So maybe I wasn't very clear about that. So basically for a polymer, you make the separation between the bonded and the non-bonded interactions, and because the bonded interactions are usually very stiff, you can just take you can just measure these distributions and invert them, and then
part I understand, I'm asking, when you go next, you're simulating a polymer melt, for example?
Yeah.
Then you're looking for G of R for all atoms, or you're only looking at for non-bonded per correlation function? Because you're trying to get the correction to bonded.
No. I'm trying to get the correction for the non-bonded, because for the non-bonded part,
right.
it will...
But G of R includes everything.
In this case, I really mean the GFR between the non-bonded parts of the thing. Sorry, for me it's kind of obvious. So I mean, because we're talking always about the same about this thing in this GFR, usually we mean the non-bonded part. But I mean, it's just my nomenclature is not very very precise.
Why you are not doing simultaneously update on both bonded and non-bonded, right? It doesn't cost anything.
Later we did that.
For angles, it seems that sometimes you really need to iterate.
Be very careful that if it would like this, that you do not double counting of degrees of freedom, which can get you into severe trouble.
You're raising a good point.
To exclude by this approach, which might on the other hand not be the most urgent one, but at least you don't do any level counting.
I have that on a later slide in the footnote, basically, that in the case when I mean, a simple inversion doesn't is not enough. You can, of course, also make like this kind of procedure on top of the bonded interactions. But you have to be very careful in which kind of scheme you do it. So, I mean, if you have multiple interactions and you basically do the iteration on these, I mean, there's always this question, do you do all of them at the same time, or you do one at a time, or how do you do it? That's not obvious which one is the best. I mean, for these multi-component systems, you basically had the best experience with doing one at a time to basically force cross-correlations, you know, to zero.
How important is the body? Because you're assuming everything is pairwise.
Yeah, I will come to an example later also, but basically, I mean, you force everything which is free body into this thing. So, because if there are like in the high resolution system, if there are like three body interactions which basically lead to a certain RDF, then and you cannot get them by simple inversion, you basically over this iteration press the three body terms into this correction somehow.
And for a typical, let's say, for an amorphous polynomial, the interactions, three body and four body interactions are on the background of the chain. Something different when you start to develop order or structure.
No, not worrying about structure. I'm thinking more like if you have branch molecules, like hyper branch, like bottle brushes, two body really very different from, because they polarize.
And then
you're worrying about.
That's
clear. So like I said, this falls into the class where you basically, if you go on with this iteration for a long time, usually you fit like the desired distribution. And because the potential at the point R only depends on the radial distribution function at the point R, there's really no cross-correlation between different distances in this matter. And that's already one of the problems, basically. And Sasha basically came up with a smarter idea to basically take into account these cross-correlations. And the idea behind that is that you can basically write down the potential as a function of these S alphas, which is basically the unnormalized radial distribution function. And then you can make a Taylor expansion. And you get kind of these fluctuation matrix, and now you basically have correlations between distance alpha and distance gamma. So this letter basically normalizes, I mean, numbers the distances here. You can see that in this formula, and then you basically just have to invert this thing to take into account these correlation between different distances. And I mean, it's also obvious. So if this thing, I mean, if in a certain update step this thing is zero, then exactly. This is also zero then, and that means you fit the right distributions. And this one, of course, because it has this thing in it, it takes into account the correlations which were missing in the other thing. But I think will you talk about this?
Not really, because you can simultaneous, even with an iterative Boltzmann inversion, you can simultaneously update, say, angular potential, angular distribution, and non-bonded interactions, and bonded and non-bonded simultaneously.
I mean, but will you talk about this method at some point in this conference?
I already had a talk.
Okay, good. So basically, I mean, this is just like a brief summary of what he did. Like, and there's the other method, which is basically the force matching scheme, and I will give a very nice talk about that. And I will just summarize. Basically, you're looking for a certain kind of coarse-grained force field, which tries to minimize the force acting on the beads in the coarse-grained representation, and the advantage of this method is, of course, first of all, it's non-iterative. So, like, you solve that thing, and then you are done. And the disadvantage, of course, you have to kind of plug in a certain type of force field here. And I think what people usually do is they use a spline for that. And then this basically boils down to this square fit. And this thing doesn't really, it's not made for fitting the distributions. It's really made for matching the multibody REF, which multibody PLF, which sometimes leads to the fact that if you use that method, you will not recover the same structure in all cases. So, and with all these methods at hand, I mean, when I basically joined that field, I mean, there was like, I guess like 3 packages for doing that, and we were always a bit worried that it really depends on the implementation, and it's not very easy to use the different methods and to compare them, and that's why we started writing this vodka package. And this was a work together with another PhD student, Victor Rühle, and we designed it in a way that it's not like super efficient, but kind of, I mean, split up into modules so that we can easily add like new methods in there. And that was very successful because we added more stuff than more algorithms than the ones which I have shown before. And I just pulled out these numbers like last week. There's a website which ranks like open source codes, and they now say we are like above 500,000 if they would have paid real programmers for doing it, but because it's like PhD students, you maybe put the dot like, you know, one in front. So yeah, but I mean the important number is of course this. Yeah, we have like something like 40,000 lines of code, and I mean they say it's in the order of 10 person years what is there. So, and I think that's a lot.
We're just saying, if you're at Sandy, you move the decimal point to the other direction.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's also not clear if there should be a scale factor applied here, because like when you first start writing something, you always reinvent things, and then yeah.
I thought you were going to say that you did so many additional hours. I thought you were saying that you wrote so many additional
hours. I mean, if you trust that number, like my whole PhD wasn't a thing, yeah. So. Okay, I mean, like I said, it was not only me, it was also Victor, which was the other big contributor, and there are like a lot of other people which have contributed to it, so I think in total now it's 15 or something, and yeah, we packed that thing up so that basically you can get it with like a standard Linux distribution. You don't really have to go and compile it yourself, even if it's not hard. And one of the decisions we made when writing the package was, I mean, the most difficult part of all these iterative things is basically the MD code. And we were just very lazy, and that for that reason we said, okay, I mean, we want to build it kind of around an existing MD code so that we don't have to rewrite like this part, which is already there. And I mean, there are packages like Promise which do that very efficiently. And you can anyway not keep up with their development speed and with the set of features they have. So I mean, even if it's sometimes hard, we don't want to write our own MD code. Yeah, we always want to kind of rely on other things. And and that's what we have done. So, because most of these cross-scaling methods are related to doing some kind of analysis on the reference system or on the cross-scaling system, we also implemented a parallel analysis framework, which was very useful to have, because at some point the cross-scaling simulation will go fast because you use a very efficient MD code, but then you kind of have to do like an analysis, calculating the radial distribution function, and this is usually done in serial. And then in the end, you wait longer for the analysis than for the actual simulation. And recently, Dennis has published like an extension to that package, which can be used for simulating charge transport. And in charge transport simulations, you also map like a high high resolution system to something which is like beats, and then you basically study the hopping of charges on these beats. And so the ideas are in some sense pretty similar, and that's why they could use these mapping engines which we have in Botswana. Okay. So this is like basically like the graph, how in computer science you would see it. So we have the sampling engine on this side, and like I said, we are using an existing MD code in there, and we have Gromex as the main supported package, and then we have Espresso, which is like the in-house package was the in-house package in the Max Planck Institute. And then also, rather recently, we have like a LAMS backend, so you can basically use LAMS for doing the MD simulations. And that's very useful because LAMS is one of the few packages which actually has like non-bonded three-body interactions and stuff like this. So that is something the other two cannot do. And on the one side, we have kind of a scripting framework which runs the simulation. And then on the other hand, we have like an interface for reading all these outcome of these simulation packages and make the analysis on top there. And then our applications basically use kind of these interfaces to get the actual data. So this is just a graph how to actually do like an iterative simulations, and there's nothing complicated in there, but there are some more steps than you actually think in the beginning. So if you start with some kind of initialization, so making the potential of mean force, and then you basically initialize the simulation step, and then you make a sampling and calculate the update, and then you look if it's converged, and if not, you go on. But basically, after calculating the update, you have to do some pre-processing of these update things. You have to smooth it a bit and maybe cut like the boundaries a bit so that you don't get kind of noise into the update. And the same is basically true before the sampling. Maybe you have to do a minimization first and then do the sampling. And so there are like some steps which are basically hidden in most of the papers, and we have them all in there. So it's very easy to kind of add additional stuff which we want to do with the updates or the update of the potential. And I think the most important part is basically that I mean, this whole graph is like optimized. So you basically can start a simulation on Friday and come back on Monday, and 1,000 iterations will be done. So there's not anything you have to do to keep that going. And
I'm sorry, I missed something. In the previous graph, in the previous slide, you showed that you can be simultaneously comparing with different method, so how are you updating at the same time?
Okay,
you're going to be doing.
The input data is always the same. I mean, if you want to calculate the update for two different methods at the same time, that is slightly more complicated. But usually, you just run two simulations.
Okay, so the number of simulations is proportional to the number of methods you want to compare.
But
they will be sort of.
But most of the time, you try one of them and it doesn't work, and then you try the next one, and then. Most of the time you have a preferred method, let's say like this. And if the preferred method doesn't work for you because you need cross correlations or something like this, then you try another one. Comparing all of them at the same time is very difficult because of course like the update always depends on what kind of potential you already have. So immediately after one iteration step, the two potentials would basically diverge.
Sure.
Yeah. But you can make a mixture of them. I mean, we basically tried something very first use in inverse Monte Carlo and then go on with iterated force on inversion or something like this. So.
Okay, but for depending on the property you're trying to find. Okay.
Yeah.
So there's no real protocol that would try to collectively optimize several at the same time to see whether you get more than just either pressure or structure function or.
I mean, usually, it's also not so interesting to to compare them like after every iteration, because I have like an error plot at some point, how the two different levels converge. And basically, we would like to compare them at the same level of convergence, kind of, or the same level of runtime or something. I think like comparing them after every iteration doesn't really make a lot of sense. So, I mean, after every iteration step. Yeah, but let me come to the error plots, then we can discuss this a bit more.
So you have here a kind of control for quality of sampling.
In principle, we can calculate the error bars of the sampling, and if the error bars are big, then you, I mean, can slightly increase the length of the simulation in the next iteration, or you can throw away the whole iteration. That we can also do. Yeah, I mean, we usually use the error bar on the radial distribution function as a good measure, because if it's big, then you need to sample longer. And in the inverse Monte Carlo procedure, basically there. You can use these fluctuation metrics the amplitude of the fluctuation metrics as a measure, because in something like this, fluctuation metrics can be very unstable, and for that reason, we have that. So in the original paper where we proposed that package, we were comparing different examples, and all of them kind of have like a slight problems depending on what methods you use, and that was very very helpful to gain some insights into the different methods, because it seems like none of the methods is really perfect. And I would like to start with the water example, because there's a lot of studies in the literature where they coarse-grain water into a sphere. So basically, they put the sphere in the center of mass, and then they do it with different methods. And it's not really clear if for all the different methods you will basically get the same potential. And when we did that, we basically did a comparison between iterative Boltzmann inversion, inverse Monte Carlo, and force matching. And as you see, actually the potentials look quite similar. And you would say, well, they have two minimas. Maybe it's a bit shifted, but well, it looks pretty similar. There's a bit of structure here, which is more pronounced in iterative Boltzmann inversion than in force matching, but still, it looks pretty similar. But if you look at the radial distribution function of these different coarse-grained models, you see that IBI and inverse Monte Carlo basically do a very good job of fitting it, while force matching doesn't. And
switch for color code. Color code is valid. Yes, it's switch for color code.
Yeah. I'm really bad, so yeah. Okay. But in the end, the only line which really plays an important role is this one, and this is just different from the reference. So it is kind of clear that these two methods have to somehow fit the reference really distribution function, because these methods are made for really. Yeah. So it is not. There's no magic in there. And for force matching, it's also kind of clear, because this method isn't made to fit the radial distribution function.
You're trying to represent water by a sphere with just central radial potential, yes, not anything else. That's not.
That's not possible. It's possible to.
Well, you're using a function, you're optimizing the function, you go to the back, but that's not. That's not.
Yeah.
Test anything.
It's. Yeah, it's. These kind of models are very useful for these adaptive resolution scheme, which we have, where you basically want to replace the solvent by something. You want to have that. Outside and inside the different resolution regions, we have the same structure. So, when you replace a water molecule by a sphere, which is uncharged, I mean, it's really like a crude approximation. We cannot expect that. I mean, a lot of things will be correct. I mean, and we are only, I mean, care about the structure in this case.
Because it doesn't have the same structure. It has the same geophile, but the tetrahedral structure is not repeated.
Yeah, okay. I mean, and we are actually only looking at the two-body correlation, yeah? So
for many things, it's absolutely sufficient, yeah. If you want to do, but for many others, it's not.
What do you say?
No, it just says the inversion works for a single, yeah. Any GFR you can invert by that potential.
It would work for anything. Yeah.
There's a potential with that GFR, yeah. At least one. So,
we actually have a theory which says here that there should be one, yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Like I said, it's not really surprising that you, because this is done for something else, so that you get that. And also later, I think there was some work by Will where they added increased the basis set in which you search the potential, and then they also found something where the two-body correlation was better reproduced. Like I said, it's maybe not always obvious which method is the best, and for that, you can do that comparison from different sites, and what we compared in the one case was basically the error you make in the update, depending on the number of measurements you do in the crosswind simulation. So basically, this is like the number of snapshots we took. So basically, you can see this as the length of the trajectory, and this is basically the error you make in the potential update if you would take the same trajectory but throw away some of the snapshots. And what you see there is that. The error of the that you make in this update is by a factor 10 kind of smaller for the iterative Boltzmann inversion than for the IMC method. And there's this basically scale, I mean, goes with 1 over the square root of the length of the trajectory, which is also clear. And which that basically tells you that the error you make in the update is maybe for the same statistics better in iterative Boltzmann inversion than in IMC. But but when you look at the error you make in the convergence, you see that IMC basically needs less numbers of iterations to come to reasonable convergence in the radial distribution function. So I mean, basically for IMC, it's enough to do maybe 1 or 2 or 3 iterations, and then you already reach reasonably good accuracy, while with the same statistics, you need like a lot more iterations in the iterative Boltzmann inversion to do the same thing. The problem basically starts if you want to go like to much higher accuracy down there, because then you really need very long trajectories, and also like the IDI will at some point basically scatter around a certain value.
There you get in problems with your error, your GFR is not that accurate.
Yeah, I mean, basically the problem then is that the error is mainly determined by the error of the radial distribution function that you. Which you have
better than the Boltzmann simulation. How
about
in the full atomistic simulation?
Yeah, okay, I mean, the RDF of the atomistic simulation I always take as God given, so it has an error bar, but I mean.
Yeah, that's but that error bar is bigger than.
Yeah.
your convergence issue. It's just the point where it's not worth pursuing anymore.
Yeah, okay, that's the main point. I mean, at some point, I mean, you will basically only have differences in the measure of the noise. So then you either need the more accurate RDF in the Coxcox simulation or more accurate RDF in the heuristic simulation.
Could you give us some understanding of the measure of the error? So for instance, in your previous graph, it looked like it was perfect. So how many iterations do you get before you can't, I mean, where do you get to the point where you can't see the difference in this measure?
You mean here?
Well, I mean, so on the previous graph, you showed basically perfect agreement between the radial distribution functions from my eye.
Yeah, okay. I mean, this is...
And so where on that curve do you get to the point that you can't actually see the errors?
This is really like integrating the difference of the radial distribution function up over the whole interval. And you see it's like 1/100. So
okay.
It's I mean, it basically sums up for all the values there. It's not, by eye, you can never actually see it. So I mean, also this comparison is maybe in that sense a bit academic, yeah. But of course there's an error you make. And depending on the quantity you look at in the cosmic model, these errors can play an important role. Because, for example, if you want to develop a cosmic model which has the right composability or fits the proper buff integrals, I mean, all these errors basically sum up in this quantity. And then it's important to know how big the error is.
But if you compare to different emissive trajectories and look at your resulting coarse grain potential, would that error be realistic?
No.
So then, I mean, wouldn't you be better off comparing? I mean, if you have different emissive seeds or something, and you have different trajectories, I mean, there is no point of fine tuning coarse grain potential for something which is anatomistic would not be reproducible.
Yes, Michael, but in order to say something about that, you have to understand the method there as well first.
Yeah.
I can go back to that. That's what
but why right. Can't you run several parallel anatomistic and then do cross error between them?
But they are not, if you have a typical liquid, they are not more accurate than if you take one longer run.
Come again? It depends on the relaxation function. I mean, if your runtime is not much longer.
You're not thinking of a polynomial.
Or something that has some relaxation as well.
Then you run into other problems. How to set up that they are statistically independent, but that you have a proper distribution and things like this.
But then how, I mean, in your case, how do you choose? Is it box size versus CPU time? For the missing, which would be better? I mean, how do you optimize it to?
I mean, usually for the optimistic reference, we run the biggest thing we can.
Right, but if you take a very big thing, you can only buy for a very short time.
Yeah.
Is there a protocol that tells a user how to choose?
Basically, the optimistic reference is an input. Yeah. So, I mean, the package is really about you give it a radial distribution function and you get out the potential deciding about the methods. It's like the garbage in, garbage out. So if you give it like a very rough reference radial distribution function, it will maybe find a potential which gives you exactly something which has that. But if the input already has big error bars, the output will also have them. So it would be interesting to think about this, but this would immediately increase the space of what the package has to do a lot. If it would also provide the reference data. So. Okay. I mean, there was one minor point where I skipped over, and that is basically that for the IMC, the comparison is not 100% fair. Because we had to, in this case, we had to apply smoothing on the update. So basically, this was what we actually got out with. It was very very noisy. And then we put a spline through it and used this as the update. So comparison sometimes is of the different letters pretty hard because all of them need kind of a little bit of tweaking. And this is not always, not really necessary in all cases, but for, we had to do this because we were using the same length of trajectory, and that is why I think for IMC this was a bit short.
Still, I'm a bit surprised about this noise because in our software we do not have this noise in Burst Monte Carlo.
In yours?
Yeah. But we have Monte Carlo engine to sample, not very good dynamics. I mean, maybe it's good. Maybe it is related to that.
I'm not sure because in the end it doesn't really matter how you generate. I mean, how you generate.
Yeah, it doesn't kind of make that sound, right? Such thing like.
I think in this case it's really from the fact that we
very easily
that we choose a certain length of trajectory, and for IMC, if you don't sample this correlation matrix well enough, you will of course get like all these noise in there. I mean, because the problem of the method is, of course, that and you have this fluctuation matrix, which is usually like small numbers, and then you invert them. So, yeah. Okay. In Water was one of these examples where the results of force matching and the structure-based methods was very different. And that inspired us to look into like an example the force matching community is always using, and that's like liquid methanol. And for liquid methanol, the potentials also look again very similar. And even force matching can basically reproduces like the two-body correlation function pretty well. And I'm not 100% sure why is that, but I think the hand-waving explanation is basically that there are not so many like three-body correlations, and that's why this works much better. So Will, can you comment on that? Because I haven't really thought about it anymore.
I don't have a really great explanation either, just that the many body probability distribution is better fit with the simple pair potential in the case of a system for water. It's probably like you said, because there's less important many body correlations, I think would be my guess.
That's also what I thought about this. In this case, we were running in some kind of trouble with inverse Monte Carlo a bit because when we were comparing like different system sizes, we basically ended up with very different looking potentials. I mean, all of them would basically exactly fit these points here. So I mean, it's not like that that you would see it in this plot. You really see it when you look at the potentials. And there's now two things you have to say about this. The first thing is that all these cross-cutting procedures, they usually come out with a pressure which is not the one which the optimistic system has. And it's obvious that this one has a much bigger pressure than this one. And we were just really puzzled why is that. And it took us basically 2 years to find out. The reason why is that is basically for the small system, I mean there is a big error on this correlation matrix, and that's why you basically end up with this potential. And the other thing is, later we were plugging in a slightly different reference redistribution function. I mean, after it was always an open question after the paper, and then we plugged in a slightly different reference thing, and then also with the small system we could basically get like a potential like this. So what is the conclusion from that? It's like, you have to be very careful what kind of input data you give it and how big is the error bar on the input data. And the second thing is but you cannot use this as a black box. You always have to look at the potentials in the end if they physically make any sense at all. Because this thing, of course, well, I mean, it's really questionable if this is a good Poisson model in any sense, even if it would reproduce the ready distribution function very well. If I would take these potentials and do the cosmic simulation, you would see no difference there. So, I mean, I think I have the plot actually with me. Do I? Yeah, I mean, that's the one. So that's the one I'm talking about. I wasn't aware that I also put it in. So basically, that's what I'm saying. The different potentials are here, and that's like the plot of the radius.
How many molecules are atomistic?
In the atomistic thing, I think we had also 8,000 and a very long simulation.
But did you have the same number of molecules in atomistic and constrained? Also, when you have 1,000? Because when you use 1,000 in your simulation, you need
no,
to have
I mean, many we were thinking that the...
much than...
I think that's exactly what I said. So it's really important what you plug in. Because in this case, I think we always plugged in the 8,000 thing.
Okay, and this is the reason, because I see that for inversion of Kali, it's important that you have in your simulation exactly the same condition, same book size and number of particles, and as atomistic.
So basically,
the methanol has very short range correlations, so that should, in this case, I'm surprised that.
That was also what we thought. I mean, like for.
They almost feel like proteins anymore.
Yeah. And we were doing like a very long atomistic simulation with a big box, and we were thinking, okay, this is really like the. Where the distribution function, which is the actual redistribution function for this reference system, but it seems like there are very tiny differences which can screw it up. So
if you do this at 1,000 atomistic molecules, you claim you would get.
No. I mean the.
If you use atomistic 1,000, the cross grain 1,000, the potential will be better.
I guess, maybe the reason that different number of
molecules. I would be surprised
if
this would be that much better.
Because they always look the same, but it's really like, in this case the reference simulation is really like the dots, and they were made with 8,000 molecules, but I think later we also looked at smaller systems and, it's still in line with looks the same, but I mean, the small differences, I think because of this inversion, can make a big difference in potential.
It may be instructive to compute also careful, but
actually, we didn't do it for methanol, but for a different system in the end, and then you can really see how it will develop. Yeah.
Can you look at the eigenvectors of the fluctuation matrix to figure out which degrees of freedom? I mean, you have this tremendous insensitivity to the potential. In the structure, at least in the radial distribution function. If you look at the eigenvectors of the covariance matrix, or the fluctuation matrix, that tells you something about, this basically says there's some null space, right, with respect to which changes in the potential don't change the structure. And you have you looked at those eigenvectors and that null space to try to understand it?
I mean, we tried to understand it, and I think I actually have the plot of the correlation matrix with me, how big are the values. But I think we didn't come to any obvious conclusion. So that's also something which we tried at some point, but didn't lead to any real results. So that's why we didn't look into it anymore. But it's for sure some interesting question. Yeah.
We have full trajectory, so can we try looking at some other correlation function besides the body that would improve your potential?
I looked for some other system on these eigenvectors and eigenvalues, but I cannot say that they give much information, because it seems they are dependent on what is your grid size. You divide twice more intervals and you can get completely different. So I'm not sure that they will give sense.
I think I don't have the ones for the for the methanol, the three, but basically for water, the matrix kind of looks like this. And I'm also not sure anymore about the normalization, because this is like a relatively long time ago. So
Can I ask about another thing? When you showed us the G of R's, it looked very nice, except out at the very far end, at large R. The other one, I guess, that you were showing us. And I guess my question is, what...
Are you mean here?
With the 1,000, it's, no, the 1,000, 2,000, 8,000. The G of R's were very good, except out at the edge. What are you assuming about G of R for R greater than your fit range? Are you assuming that it's rigorously one, or are you just letting that be undetermined? Because it seems like that could be...
Yeah, we let that be undetermined. Because at some point, you have a certain size of the metrics, and the metrics basically determines how many of these points you have along the R line. And at some point you just stop. Yeah. But of course, I mean, if there would be still structure in the thing, in the two-body correlation function, of course you throw something away.
I'm just wondering if you force it rigorously to be. I mean, that's to some degree that's an indeterminate problem because you're not. In fact, you don't have a reference G of R that you're finding the potential to fit. You've got an infinite.
Okay, I mean, if you force
it to be one rigorously beyond some scale, then at least you have a true reference G of R, and you think it must at some level be unique at that point.
Yeah, I think I misunderstood your question. So, okay. I mean, of course, like also in the reference system, you only measure it up to a certain point, and after that you don't know the values, but because you see it goes to one, you assume, of course, it's one there. Approximately one.
Yeah. But here in this case, it's obviously not quite one, right? Yeah. It's like 0.1, 0.05.
Yeah.
Would that solve this problem if you just took it out to two? I mean, if you redid the inverse Monte Carlo and you just chain and you increased the grid up to two, and so it actually did get close.
I think we also did that at some point, and I think the potentials are like closer together. But of course, like the inversion of the metrics goes with the size of the metric. So you know, if you make it bigger, it gets less efficient. So but as I remember, it was like this. So that once you go out, you made it closer than before. But I don't have the plots with me. I mean, okay, then we did like another example from the force matching community, and this is this we map hexane to a like a chain with three beads with when we call this A and B. So the A beads are the outer beads and B is the center bead. And then we looked at the angle distribution and just inverted this distribution to come up with a potential. And if you do that, you basically get a potential which looks like this. And if you then do the coarse-grained simulation and measure the angle distribution again, you will get something which looks exactly like the reference simulation, which means that in this case, the simple Boltzmann inversion is really like a good approximation for getting this interaction. And
the atomistic model, that's not true. You have some forces outside of the plane,
yeah.
And those forces get